Why? Because there are no small matters, just as there is no small life. The life of an insect, a spider, his life is as large as yours, and yours is as large as mine. Life is life. You wish to live as much as I do. You have spent 7 months of hell waiting day after day for what you needed, the way a spider waits. Think about the spider, Joe Fernwright. He makes his web. Then he makes a little silk cave at the end of the web to sit in. He holds strands that lead to every part of the web so that he will know when something to eat, something he must have to live, arrives. He waits. A day goes by. 2 days. A week. He waits on. There is nothing he can do but wait. The little fisherman of the night. And perhaps something comes and he lives, or nothing comes and he waits and he thinks it won't come in time, it's too late. And he is right. He dies still waiting. But for me, Joe said, something came in time. I came, Glimmung said. Joe said, did you pick me because of... He hesitated. Out of pity? Never, Glimmung said. The raising will take great skills, many knowings and crafts, vast numbers of arts. Do you still have that potsherd with you? Joe got the small divine fragment from his coat pocket. He put it down on the lunch counter beside the empty bowl of soup. Thousands of them, Glimmung said. You have, I should guess, 100 more years of life. It can't be done in 100 years. You will step among them, the beautiful little pieces, until the day you die. And you will get your wish. You will be until the end. And having been, you will always exist. Glimmung looked at the Omega wristwatch that circled his humanoid wrist. They will be announcing your flight in 2 minutes. After he had been strapped to his couch and the pressure helmet had been screwed over his head, he managed to twist around so that he could hopefully see his flight companion, the person beside him. Mali Yoyez, the tag read. He squinted and saw that it was a girl, non-Terran but humanoid. And then the first thrust rockets ignited and the ship began to rise. He had never been off Earth before, and he realized this starkly as the weight on him grew. This is not like going from New York to Tokyo, he said to himself, gaspingly. With incalculable effort, he managed to turn his head so that he could once again see the non-Terran girl. She had become blue. Maybe it's natural to her race, Joe thought. Maybe I've turned blue, too. Maybe I'm dying, he said to himself. And then the booster rockets came on, and Joe Fernwright passed out. When he awoke, he heard only the sound of the Mahler Fourth and a low murmur of voices. I'm the last to come out of it, he said to himself gloomily. The pert, dark-haired stewardess busily unscrewed his pressure helmet and shut off his separate supply of oxygen. Feeling better, Mr. Fernwright? The stewardess inquired as she delicately recombed his hair. Miss Yoyez has been reading the biographical material you gave us before flight time, and she is very interested in meeting you. There, now your hair just looks ever so fine. Don't you think so, Miss Yoyez? How do you do, Mr. Fernwright? Miss Yoyez asked him in a heavily accented voice. I have been glad to know you very. The lengthitude of our trip, I am surprised not to talk to you, because I think we in common much have. May I see Miss Yoyez's biographical material? Joe asked the stewardess. It was handed to him, and he scanned it rapidly. Favorite animal? A squimp. Favorite color? Reg. Favorite game? Monopoly. Favorite music? Koto, classical, and Kimio Eto. Born in the Prox system, which made her a pioneer of sorts. I think, Miss Yoyez said, we are in the same undertaking, several of us with the inclusion of I and me. You and me, Joe said. Your natural Earth? I've never been off Earth in my life, Joe said. Then this is your first space flight. Yes, he said. He eyed her covertly and found her attractive. Her short-clipped bronze hair formed an effective contrast to her light gray skin. In addition, she had one of the smallest waists he had ever seen. And in the permoform spray foam blouse and pants, this as well as the rest of her stood cleanly revealed. You're a marine biologist, he said, reading more of her biographical material. Indeed, I am to determine the depth of coral infestation of... She paused, brought forth a small dictionary, and looked up a word. Submerged artifacts. He felt curiosity toward one point. He asked, How did the Glimmung manifest himself to you? Manifest, Miss Yoyez echoed. She searched through her small dictionary. Materializing, the stewardess said brightly. There's a circuit of the ship linking us with a translation computer back on Earth. At each couch is an earphone and a microphone. Here are yours, Mr. Fernwright, and here are yours, Miss Yoyez. My Terran linguistic skills are returning, Miss Yoyez said, rejecting the earphone. To Joe, she said, How did Glimmung appear to you? Joe asked. Physically, what did he look like? Big, short, portly? Miss Yoyez said, Glimmung initially manifests himself in an aquatic framework, inasmuch as he proper often rests at the bottom of the oceans of his planet in the... She called her mind. The vicinity of the sunken cathedral. That explained the oceanic transformation at the police station. But subsequently, how did he appear? He asked. The same? The second time he came to I, Miss Yoyez said, he manifested himself as a laundry up basket. Can she mean that? Joe wondered. A basket of laundry? He thought then of the game. The old preoccupation abruptly stirred into life inside him. Miss Yoyez, he said, perhaps we could make use of the computer translator. They can be very interesting. Let me tell you about an incident that occurred in automated translating of a Soviet article on engineering years ago. The term... Please, Miss Yoyez said. I can't follow you, and additionally, we have things other to discuss. We must ask everyone and find out how many has been employed by Mr. Glimmung. She fitted the earphone to the side of her head, lifted the microphone, and pressed all the buttons on the translation console beside her. Would everyone who is going to Plowman's planet to work in Mr. Glimmung's undertaking raise their hands, please? So anyway, Joe said, this article on engineering, when the computer translated it into English, had one strange term in it that appeared over and over. Water sheep. What the hell does that mean? They all asked. I don't know, they all said. Well, what finally they... Miss Yoyez broke in. Of the 45 of us aboard the ship, 30 are in Glimmung's pay. She laughed. Perhaps now is the time for us to establish a union and work collectively. A stern-looking gray-haired man at the front end of the section said, That's not a half-bad idea, actually. But he's already paying so much, a timid little fellow on the left side pointed out. Is it in writing? The gray-haired man said. He's made oral promises to us, and then he's threatened us, or at least so I gather. Anyhow, he threatened me. He came on like the Day of Judgment. It really took the wind out of my sails. And if you knew me, you'd know it's rare when anyone can do that to Harper Baldwin. So anyhow, Joe said, they finally managed to trace it back to the original paper, in Russian, and you know what it was? It was hydraulic ram, and it came out in English as water sheep. Now, on the basis of this, I and a number of distinguished colleagues... Oral promises, a sharp-faced middle-aged woman toward the rear of the section said, are not enough. Before we do any work for him, we should have written contracts. Basically, when you get down to it, he's gotten us on this ship by intimidation. Then think what a threat he'll be when we get to Plowman's planet, Miss Yoyez pointed out. All the passengers were silent for a moment. We just call it the game, Joe said. In addition, the gray-haired man said, we must remember that we're only a small part of the workforce that Glimmung's been recruiting all over the galaxy. I mean, we can act collectively to hell and gone, and what does it matter? We're just a drop in the bucket, we hear, or eventually we'll be when he gets the others onto his damn planet, which could be any time. What we'll have to do, Miss Yoyez said, is to organize ourselves here, and then when we reach Plowman's planet, we'll probably be staying at one of the major hotels, and once there we can contact some or all of the others he's recruited, and then possibly we can form a union effective. A heavy-set red-faced man said, But isn't Glimmung a... He gestured. A supernatural creature? A deity? There are no deities, the timid little fellow on the left side of the compartment said. I used to put strong faith in them at an earlier age of my life, but after keen and very recurrent frustration and disappointment and disillusionment, I gave up. The red-faced man said, in terms of what he can do, what does it matter what you call it? Vigorously, he declared, in relation to us, Glimmung has the power and nature of a deity. For example, he can manifest himself simultaneously on 10 or 15 planets all over the galaxy and yet still remain on Plowman's planet. Yes, he manifested himself to me in a scary fashion, as that gentleman up front just pointed out, but I'm convinced it's the real thing. Glimmung made us come here. He coerced us. I know he did. In my case, the police became peculiarly interested in my affairs about the same time that Glimmung first approached me. The way it worked out was that I more or less wound up having a choice between picking up on Glimmung's proposition or going to jail as a political prisoner. In the name of God, Joe thought, perhaps Glimmung played a hand in getting the QCA to drop in on me. And then the harness bulls who hung over me when I was giving away quarters, the cops who busted me, they may have been steered there by Glimmung. Several people were talking at once now. Listening intently, Joe made out the general drift of their discourses. They, too, were telling about rescues from police vehicles and stations by Glimmung. This changes everything, Joe said to himself.
He got me to do an illegal act, a matronly woman was saying. He got me to write a check to one of the government's beneficial organizations in a fit of passion. The check bounced, and of course the police pulled me right in. When I got on the ship, I jumped bail. I'm amazed they let me go, the QCA, I mean. I thought they'd stop me at the spaceport.
That is strange, Joe reflected. The QCA could have stopped all of us. Glimmung didn't take us to Plowman's planet by some vast display of his power. He had us take a regular flight, was himself, in fact, at the spaceport, apparently to see that we didn't back out. Does that mean, Joe asked himself, that there's no genuine antagonism between Glimmung and the QCA? He tried to remember the current law dealing with knowledge and skills of unusual value. It was a felony, he recalled, for a person to leave Earth if that person had skills which couldn't be made available to the government or people in his absence. My statement as to my skills and knowledge was routinely okayed, he remembered. They just glanced at it and stamped it and went on to the next one. And the next one was probably someone else with a special and highly useful skill on his way to Plowman's planet. And they okayed him too, it would seem. He felt a deep and abiding insecurity, thinking this. A common basis between Glimmung and the police. If that were the case, he was, for all intents and purposes, as much in the hands of the authorities as he would have been if he had remained at the police station. Perhaps even more so. On Plowman's planet, he would not be covered by the modicum of statutes protecting the accused. As someone had said already, once they reached Plowman's planet, they would be entirely in Glimmung's possession, for whatever he wanted done. They would be, in essence, extensions of Glimmung. It was another corporate existence toward which he was heading, and he had in no sense escaped from anyone or anything. And this would be true for all the others. Hundreds, or perhaps even thousands of them, flowing to Plowman's planet from all over the galaxy. Jesus, he thought in despair. But then he thought of something, something that Glimmung, in humanoid form, had said in the restaurant of the spaceport. There are no small lives. And the little fisherman of the night, as Glimmung had called the lowly spider. Listen, Joe said aloud into his microphone, and he had all the buttons down. Everyone in the compartment was hearing him, whether they wanted to or not. Glimmung told me something, he said, at the spaceport. He told me about life waiting for something to come along and sustain it, and that thing, that event, never coming from any lives. He said that this undertaking, this raising of Held Scala, was that thing, that event for me. In his mind, he felt his conviction grow until it became absolute and powerful, and he felt it change him. It woke him up until, by now, he could say, as Glimmung put it, I am. Everything that has been latent, Glimmung said, that has potential, all of it will be actualized. I felt, Joe hesitated, trying to find the exact word he wanted. He knew, he said finally, as the other passengers listened in silence, about my life. He knew it from the inside, as if he were inside it with me, looking out. He's telepathic, the timid little fellow piped up. There was a general stir of agreement. It's more than that, Joe said. Hell, the police have equipment that manufactures telepathy, and they use it all the time. They used it on me yesterday. Miss Yo-Yo said, I experienced that also. To the others, she said, Mr. Fernwright is correct. Glimmung looked into the basis of my life.
It was as if he saw all the way back through my life, saw it all pass along and lead here to this point. And he saw that at this point it wasn't worth living, except for this.
But he conspired with the police, the gray-haired man said, but Miss Yoyas interrupted him.
We don't know that he did. I think we're experiencing panic. I think Glimmung planned this undertaking to save us. I think he saw us all, the futilities of our various lives, and where they were leading, and he loved us because we were alive. And he did what he could to help us. The raising of Heldskala is only a pretext. All of us, and there may be thousands, are the real purpose of this.
She paused a moment, and then said,
3 days ago I tried to kill myself. I attached the tube of my vacuum cleaner to the tailpipe of my surface car, and then I put the other end of the tube inside the car and I got in and started the motor.
And then you changed your mind? A slender girl with wispy corn-silk hair asked.
No, Miss Yoyes said. The turbine misfired and knocked the tube loose. I sat for an hour in the cold for nothing.
Joe said, Would you have tried again?
I planned to do it today, she said levelly, and this time in a fashion that wouldn't fail.
The red-faced, red-haired man said, Hear what I have to say for what it's worth. He sighed, a ragged, hoarse noise of resignation and unease. I was going to do it, too. Not me, the gray-haired man said. He looked exceedingly angry. Joe felt the strength of the man's wrath. I signed on because there was a great deal of money involved. Do you know what I am? He glanced around at all of them. I'm a psychokineticist, the best psychokineticist on Earth. Grimly, he reached out his arm, and the briefcase at the rear of the compartment flew directly toward him. Fiercely, he grabbed it, squeezing it. Squeezing it, Joe thought, the way Glimmung squeezed me.
Glimmung is here, Joe said, among us.
To the gray-haired man, he said, You are Glimmung, and yet you're violently arguing against our trusting him. You. The gray-haired man smiled. No, friend, I'm not Glimmung. I'm Harper Baldwin, psychokineticist consultant for the government. As of yesterday, anyhow.
But Glimmung is here somewhere, a plump woman with tangled doll hair said. She was knitting and had said nothing up until now. He's right, that man there.
Mr. Fernwright, the stewardess offered helpfully. May I introduce you to one another? This attractive girl beside Mr. Fernwright is Miss Molly Yoyes. And this gentleman...
She droned on, but Joe did not listen. Names weren't important, except perhaps the name of the girl seated beside him. He had, during the last 40 minutes, become more and more favorably inclined toward her spare, sparse, even bleak beauty. Nothing at all like Kate, he thought to himself. The opposite. This is a truly feminine woman. Kate's a frustrated man, and that's the kind which castrates right and left. Harper Baldwin, the introductions over, said in his overbearing, ultra-firm voice, I think our status, our true status, is that of slaves. Let's stop a minute and review this whole matter, how we happen to be here. The stick and the carrot, am I right? He glanced from side to side, seeking confirmation.
Plowman's planet, Miss Yoyes spoke out, is not a backward, deprived planet. It has an advanced society active and evolving on it. True, it's not yet a civilization, in the strict sense of the word, but it's not herds of food-gatherers, nor even clans of food-planters. It has cities, laws, a variety of arts ranging from the dance to a modified form of 4D chess.
That's not true, Joe said with scathing anger. Everyone turned toward him, startled by his tone.
One vast old creature lives there, apparently infirm. Nothing about an advanced city society.
Wait a minute, Harper Baldwin said. If there's one thing Glimmung is not, it's infirm. Where'd you get your information, Fernwright? From the government encyclopedia?
Joe said uncomfortably, Yes, and secondhand, too. If the encyclopedia described Glimmung as infirm, Miss Yoyes said evenly, I'd be interested to know what else it said. I'm just curious to see how far your knowledge of Plowman's planet departs from the reality situation.
With growing discomfort, Joe said, Dormant. Advanced age, hence senile, hence harmless. And harmlessness had not been apparent in Glimmung, at least as he had appeared to Joe, and to the others. Standing, Molly Yoyes said,
if you'll please excuse me, I think I'll go sit in the lounge and perhaps read a magazine or nap.
In brisk short steps, she departed from the passenger compartment.
I think, the plump woman busily knitting said, without looking up from her work, that Mr. Fernride ought to go to the lounge and apologize to Miss whatever her name is.
His ears red and the back of his neck prickling, Joe got to his feet and followed after Molly Yoya's. As he descended the three carpeted steps, an eerie feeling came over him, as if, he thought, I'm going to my death. Or is it life, for the first time, the process of being born? Someday he would know, but not now.
Chapter 6. He found Miss Yoyes, as she had declared, seated in one of the great soft couches of the lounge, reading Ramparts. She did not look up at him, but he took it for granted that she was aware of him. Therefore he said,
How did you happen to know so much about Plowman's Planet, Miss Yoyes? I mean, you didn't get your knowledge out of the encyclopedia, obviously, as I did.
Reading on, she said nothing. After a pause, Joe seated himself near her, hesitated then, wondering what to say. Why had her statements about the society on Plowman's Planet angered him so? He didn't know. It seemed as irrational to him now as it had seemed to the others.
We have a new game, he said finally.
She continued reading.
You search the archives for the funniest headlines ever printed, each player topping the others.
She still did not speak.
I'll tell you the headline that struck me as the funniest, he said. It was hard to find. I had to look all the way back to 1962.
Molly glanced up. Her face showed no great emotion, no resentment. Merely detached curiosity of a social nature. No more.
And what was your headline, Mr. Fernwright?
Elmo Plaskett sinks giants, Joe said.
Who was Elmo Plaskett?
That's the point, Joe said. He came up from the minors. Nobody ever heard of him. That's what makes it funny. I mean, Elmo Plaskett. He came up for one day, hit one home run.
Basketball?
Miss Yoyes asked.
Baseball. Oh, yes, the game of inches.
Joe said, You've been on Plowman's Planet?
For a moment she did not answer, and then she said simply, Yes.
He noticed that she had rolled the magazine into a tight cylinder, holding it with both hands very tightly, and her face showed severe stress.
So you know firsthand what it's like.
And you encountered Glimmung?
Not really. We knew he was there, half dead or half alive, whichever way you'd put it. I don't know. Excuse me.
She turned away. Joe started to say something further, and then he saw in a corner of the lounge what appeared to be an SSA machine. Getting to his feet, he went over to it and inspected it.
May I be of help, sir? The stewardess said, and approached him. Would you like me to seal the lounge off so that you and Miss Yoyes can make love?
No, he said. I'm interested in this.
He touched the control panel of the SSA machine.
How much does it cost to use it?
SSA service is free during your flight for one time, the stewardess said. After that, it takes two genuine dimes. Do you want me to set it up for you and Miss Yoyes?
I'm uninterested, Molly Yoyes spoke up.
How unfair to Mr. Fernwright, the stewardess said, still smiling, but in her voice conveying a reprimand. He can't use it alone, you understand.
What do you stand to lose? Joe asked Molly Yoyes.
You and I has no future together, she answered.
But that's the whole point of the SSA machine, Joe protested. To find out what...
I know what it finds out, Molly Yoyes interrupted. I've used they before.
Okay, she said abruptly, so you can see how it works. As a...
She searched for the word.
Experience.
Thanks, Joe said.
The stewardess began setting up the SSA machine in a rapid, efficient fashion, meanwhile explaining it.
SSA stands for Subspecie Aeternitatis, that is, something seen outside of time. Now, many individuals imagine that an SSA machine can see into the future, that it is precognitive. This is not true. The mechanism, basically a computer, is attached via electrodes to both your brains, and it swiftly stores up immense quantities of data about each of you. It then synthesizes these data and, on a probability basis, extrapolates as to what would most likely become of you both if you were, for example, joined in marriage or perhaps living together.
I will have to shave 2 spots of hair on both your heads, please, in order to attach the electrodes. She brought out the little stainless steel instrument. How far ahead are you interested in? She asked as she shaved the 2 spots on Joe's skull and then on Molly Yoyez's. 1 year, 10 years? You're free to choose, but the less time elapsed you pick, the more accurate the extrapolation will be. 1 year, Joe said. 10 years seemed too remote. Probably he would not even be alive then. Is that agreeable to you, Miss Yoyez? The stewardess asked. Yes. It will take the computer 15 to 17 minutes to gather, store, and process all the data, the stewardess said, as she attached 2 electrodes to Joe's scalp and then 2 to Molly Yoyez's. Merely sit still and relax. There is, of course, no discomfort. You won't feel a thing. Molly Yoyez said tartly, You and I, Mr. Fernwright, together a whole year. What a mellow, friendly year. You did this before? Joe asked. With another man? Yes, Mr. Fernwright. And the extrapolation was unfavorable? She nodded. I'm sorry I rubbed you the wrong way back there, Joe said, feeling humble and profusely apologetic. You called me a... Molly Yoyez flipped through her dictionary. A liar in front of all, and I have been there and you have not. What I meant to say, he began, but the stewardess interrupted him. The SSA computer is gathering data from your minds now. It would be best if you would relax and not quarrel for a time. If you could sort of gently free-float, let your minds open wide, and let the probes gather data. Think of nothing in particular. That's hard to do, Joe reflected. Under these circumstances. Maybe, he thought, Kate was right about me. In 10 minutes, I managed to insult Miss Yoyez, my flight companion, and an attractive girl. He felt gloomy and oppressed. All I have to offer her is Elmo Plaskett Sinks Giants. But maybe, he thought suddenly, she would be interested in pot healing. Why didn't I talk about that the first time around? He asked himself. After all, that's the basis on which we're here. Our skills, experience, knowledge, training. I'm a pot healer, he said aloud. I know, Molly Yoyez said. I read your biographical material, remember? But she did not sound so miffed now. Her hostility, conjured up by his ineptness, had abated. Are you interested in pot healing? Joe asked. I'm fascinated by it, she answered. That's why I so... She gestured, then again consulted her dictionary. Delighted to sit and talk with you. Tell me, is the pot perfect again? Not mended, but, like you say, healed. Joe said, A healed ceramic piece is in the exact condition as before it broke. Everything fuses, everything flows. Of course, I have to have all the pieces. I can't do it with a fraction of the pot not present. I'm beginning to talk like she does, he said to himself. She must be a strong personality, and I'm subconsciously sensing this. As Jung pointed out, there is the anima archetype, which men experience when they encounter women. The archetypal image projected onto first one woman, and then the next, giving them a charismatic power. I had better be careful, he reflected. After all, my involvement with Kate suggests that my anima figure is strong-willed and dominating, rather than receptive and passive. I don't want to make the same mistake all over again, he said to himself. The mistake called Catherine Hurley Blaine. The SSA computer has obtained the data, the stewardess informed him and Molly Yoyez. She removed the electrodes from their scalps. It will take 2 or 3 minutes for it to process them. What form does its extrapolation take? Joe asked. Written on a paper ribbon in punch form, or... You will be presented pictorially with a representative moment of your 2 lives entwined together 1 year from now, the stewardess said. Projected in 3D and color on the far wall. She lowered the lights in the lounge. Can I smoke? Molly Yoyez said. We're not bound by Terran law out here. The smoking of tobacco cigarettes is forbidden on the ship during its entire flight, the stewardess said, because of the high oxygen content of the retained atmosphere. The lights dimmed. Everything around Joe sank into cloudy darkness, and each object became indistinct, including the girl beside him. A moment passed, and then an illuminated square materialized in depth near the SSA machine. Colors flashed by, colors and variegated images. He saw himself at work healing pots. He saw himself eating dinner. He saw her seated at her vanity table combing her hair. the images continued to flutter past, and then, all at once, the visual representation locked into place. He saw, in 3D and in color, himself and Molly holding hands and walking, slowly, along the twilight beach of some deserted other world. The fisheye lens system zoomed in, and he saw his own face and hers. Both their faces expressed the most tender love possible. He knew at once, seeing his expression a year from now, that he had never had such a look on his face. Life had never held anything like that before for him. Perhaps, he thought, it had never held this for her either. He glanced toward her, but could not make out her features. He could not see how she was taking this.
"My, but you two look happy," the stewardess said.
Molly Yoyez said, "Please leave us, now." "Well," the stewardess said, "I'm very sorry I was here at all." She left the lounge. The door clicked after her.
"They're everywhere," Molly Yoyez said by way of explanation. "The entire flight, they never leave you. Leave alone."
"But she showed us how the mechanism worked," Joe said.
"Hell, I can make a SSA machine work. I've it several times done."
She sounded cross and tense, as if what she saw did not appeal to her.
"It looks like we'd be good for each other," Joe offered.
"Oh, Christ!"
Molly Yoyez screeched. She banged her fist down on the arm of her chair.
"That's what it said before. I and Ralph, perfect outworking in everywhere. And it were not."
Her voice sank to a husky growl. Her anger pervaded the lounge, as palpable as animal musk. He felt her glowering next to him. He intuited her immense emotional reaction to the representative scene projected by the machine.
"As the stewardess explained," Joe said, "the SSA mechanism can't see the future. It can only put together all the data from my mind and yours and work out a trend of greatest probability."
"Why then use it at all?" Molly Yoyez countered.
"Consider it like fire insurance," Joe said. "You're sort of putting yourself in the position of claiming fraud because your rooming house didn't burn down after all. In other words, that you really didn't need the insurance."
"The analogy is imperfect,"
Joe said, "sorry." He, too, felt irritable now, and as before, at her.
"Do you think," Molly said bitingly, "that I'm going to go to bed with you because of this scene of us holding our hands? Tunuma mokimo hilo, ke de bifo diti karsuat,"
she said in her own tongue, obviously profanity. There sounded a knock on the door.
"Hey, you two," Harper Baldwin bawled. "We're working out the logistics of our collective employment. We need both of you."
Joe got up and made his way through the darkness of the lounge to the door. For 2 hours they haggled, and at no time did they reach any kind of joint conclusion.
"We just don't know enough about Glimmung," Harper Baldwin complained, looking weary. He then scrutinized Molly Yoyez intently. "I have the feeling that you know more about Glimmung than any of us, and a lot more than you'll admit. Hell, you even kept back from us the fact that you were ever on Plowman's planet. If you hadn't mentioned it to Fernwright..."
"Nobody asked her," Joe said, "until I did, and she said so straight out."
A muffled, gangly youth asked,
"What do you think, Miss Yoyez? Is Glimmung trying to help us, or has he in effect created a slave population of experts for his own ends? Because if it's the latter, we better get this ship turned around before we get any closer to Plowman's planet."
His voice squeaked with nervousness. Seated beside Joe, Molly Yoyez leaned toward him and said in a low voice,
"Let's get out of here. Let's go back to the lounge. We are getting nowhere, and I want to talk to you farther."
"Okay," he said, pleased. He stood up, and so did she. Together, they made their way down the aisle toward the lounge.
"There they go," Harper Baldwin complained. "What's the great attraction about the lounge, Miss Yoyez?"
Molly paused and said,
"We besport ourselves amorously."
She then continued on.
"You shouldn't have told them that," Joe said, as he and she entered the lounge and closed the door. "They probably believed you."
"But it's true," Molly said. "A person doesn't normally use the SSA machine unless he's serious. To the other person, in this case, I."
She seated herself on the couch of the lounge and reached up her arms toward him. He locked the lounge door first. It seemed, all circumstances considered, a reasonable thing to do. "Joy's too fierce," he thought, "too fierce to be expressed." Whoever said that understood. Chapter 7. In orbit around Plowman's planet, the ship began firing its retro rockets, cutting its velocity. They would be landing in half an hour. Meanwhile, Joe Fernwright amused himself in a mordant way by reading the Wall Street Journal. He had found over the years that this newspaper, out of all of them, contained the most chilling and the most recent oddities. Reading the journal was like taking a little trip into the future, 6 months or so. A new deep-depth rooming house in New Jersey, designed especially for geriatric persons, has built into it a novel circuit, designed to make the transfer of the room easy and without delay. When a roomer dies, electronic detectors in the wall register his lack of pulse and send swift circuits into action. The deceased is grappled by standard Waldos, drawn into the wall of the room, where on the spot his remains are incinerated within an asbestos chamber, thus permitting the new tenant, also a geriatric case, to take possession by noon. He ceased reading, tossed down the newspaper. "We must be better off out here," he decided, "if that's what they've got planned for us back on Earth." "I've verified our reservations," Molly said matter-of-factly. "We all have rooms at the Olympia Hotel in the largest city on the planet. Diamond Head, it's called, because it's on a winding prominence that goes 50 miles out into Mare Nostrum." "What's Mare Nostrum?" Joe asked.
"Our ocean."
He showed the item in the journal to her, and then silently to the rest of the passengers. They all read it, and then they all looked at one another for sign of a reaction.
"We made the right choice," Harper Baldwin said. The others nodded.
"That's good enough for me," Baldwin said.
He shook his head and scowled, disgust and anger contorting his face.
"And we built such a society," he rasped.
Strong-armed members of the ship's crew manually unscrewed the hatch. Outside air eddied in, smelling odd and cold. It seemed to Joe that the ocean was close. He sensed it in the air. Shielding his eyes, he gazed out against a weak sun. He distinguished the outline of a reasonably modern-looking city, and past it, hills in a mixture of brown and gray. "But the ocean is somewhere nearby," he said to himself. "Molly is right. This is a planet dominated by an ocean. And it is in the ocean that we will find everything that matters." Smiling with mechanical courtesy, the stewardesses escorted them to the open hatch and the flight of stairs which led down to the damp surface of the field. Joe Fernwright took Molly by the arm and led her down. Neither of them spoke for a time. Molly seemed absorbed in herself, taking no notice of the other people or the spaceport buildings. Bad memories, Joe reflected. Maybe what happened to her happened here. "And for me," he thought, "look what this is for me. The first interplanetary or intersystem flight in my life. This ground under me is not Earth. A very strange and important thing is happening to me." He smelled the air. Another world and another atmosphere. "It feels strange," he decided.
"Don't say," Molly said, "that you find this place unearthly. Please, for my sake."
"I don't get it," Joe said. "It is unearthly. It's completely different."
"Never mind," Molly said. "A little game Ralph and I had, a long time ago. Thingisms, we called them. Let's see if I can remember some of them."
He thought all of them up.
"The book business is hidebound, that's one. Plants are taking over the world sporadically. Let's see, the operator let me off the hook. I always liked that, it made me think of a giant hook, in fact a whole giant phone. In 1945, the discovery of atomic energy electrified the world. Do you see?"
She glanced at him.
"You don't," she said. "Never mind."
"Well, they're all true statements," Joe said, "as far as I can make out. What's the game part?"
"The Senate inquiry into modern use of sidearms was muzzled."
"How do you like that one? I saw that in a newspaper. I think Ralph found the others in newspapers or heard them over TV. I think they were all real." She added somberly,
"Everything about Ralph was real. For the beginning, but then later, no."
A careful, brown, large creature resembling a rat approached Joe and Molly. It held what appeared to be an armload of books.
"Spiddles,"
Molly said, pointing to the careful rat-like creature and to a second one which had accosted Harper Baldwin.
"One of the native life forms here, unlike Glimmung. You will find, let me see."
She counted on her fingers.
spiddles, wubs, wurges, clakes, trobes, and printers, left over from the old days. All of them older species, when the fog things of antiquity passed away. It wants you to buy a book.
The spittle touched a tiny tape recorder mounted on its belt. The tape began to speak for the spittle.
"Fully documented history of a fascinating world," it said in English, and then evidently repeated this in a variety of other tongues. Anyhow, it had stopped speaking in English.
"Buy it," Molly said.
"Pardon?" Joe said.
"Buy its book."
"You know this book? What book is it?"
Molly said with rigorous patience.
"There is only one book in this world."
"By world," Joe said, "you mean planet, or in the larger sense?"
"On Plowman's planet," Molly said, "there is just this one book."
"Don't the people get tired of reading it?"
"It changes," Molly said.
She handed the spittle a dime, which it accepted gratefully. A copy of the book was passed to her, and she in turn passed it to Joe.
Examining it, Joe said, "It has no title, and no author."
"It is written," Molly said as they walked on toward the spaceport buildings, "by a group of creatures or entities, I don't the English know, that records everything that passes on Plowman's planet. Everything, great and small."
"Then it's a newspaper."
Molly halted. She turned to face him, her eyes burning with exasperation.
"It is recorded first," she said, as steadily as she could manage. "The Kalends spin the story. They enter it in the ever-changing book without a title, and it comes to about, finally."
"Precognitive," Joe said.
"That raises a question. Which is cause? Which is effect? The Kalends wove in their altering, evolving script that the fog things would pass away. They did pass away. Did then the Kalends make them pass away? The Spittles think so."
She added, "But the Spittles are very superstitious. They naturally believe that." Joe opened the book at random. The text was not in English. He did not recognize the language or even the letters of its alphabet. But then as he leaped through it, he came to a short section in English, embedded in a mass of alien-looking entries. "The girl Molly Yoyes is an expert at removing coral deposits from submerged artifacts. Other individuals brought from various systems throughout the galaxy include geologists, structural engineers, hydraulic engineers, seismologists. One specializes in underwater robot operations, and another, an archaeologist, is a master at locating buried ancient cities. A peculiar many-armed bivalve lives in a tank of salt water and functions well in supervising the raising of sunken ships for salvage purposes. A gastropod, capable of..." At that point, the text lapsed into another language. He shut the book, pondered. "Maybe I'm mentioned in here somewhere," he said as they reached the moving sidewalk leading to the concourse sections of the spaceport terminal building complex.
"Of course," Molly said calmly. "If you look long enough, you will find it. How will you make it... pardon, how will it make you feel?"
"Eerie," he said, still pondering. A surface car, acting as a taxi, transported them to their hotel.